Hello, everyone. Welcome. I'm Carrie L., and this is Carrie L.'s Heartlink Show. And as I connect to as many hearts as possible, we are creating more freedom, light, and love, one interview at a time. I'll be introducing you to programs that will bring you insights into the great awakening that is underway on planet Earth as we approach 2012. I'll be keeping you abreast of the latest tools available for anchoring a greater and healthier reality into your life. I'll be interviewing leading-edge experts in the metaphysical, scientific, paranormal, and spiritual realms. Stay tuned for the next hour as I speak with a leading-edge spiritual scientist and the leading voice in a new biology called epigenetics. That's Bruce Lipton, PhD. And you can also call in about half an hour, the bottom of the hour, if you want with your questions. And hopefully you're on the internet and you can see the 800 numbers. But first, I'd like to introduce our guest sponsor, who is Vonda Osman, and she has created Joy Travel. And she did this after a profound spiritual experience in Egypt. And she specializes in sacred journeys for the heart and soul and has created over 66 global customized journeys. She would love you to join her Egypt Stargate Tour that will be in October, and it is a powerful transformational journey. So welcome, Vonda Osman. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can. This is so exciting, and I'm delighted to be a guest sponsor for such a fabulous person, Dr. Bruce Lipton.
Yes, and we'll go to him in a minute, but I want to know about this tour. I want you to tell us why you selected Egypt.
It's very interesting. Why Egypt has been coming spiritually to me for the last 26 years. But this year, with the tremendous amount of awakening, as you had said at the beginning, there is tremendous energies available, tremendous light energies that are available for everyone on this planet. And I was told and guided by spirit to go back for October, November to work and integrate those transformational energies. Why Egypt? Egypt is the starting point of the enduring mysteries. It is a place where alchemy and healing merged into a school to make initiates. It's a very special place. It's a stargate where the veil is very thin, and anyone can go there and walk the sands of time and feel empowered and enlightenment.
What are the dates for this tour?
It's actually October the 31st to November the 13th, and then there's an option that goes on to the 17th of November.
Why that time of year? What's going on?
I have spirit that too. It seems as though the spring, and especially the fall of this year, is so powerful in the amount of spiritual energies that are being downpoured upon this planet, which gives us the opportunity to really work with the light and work with quantum energies and work with a new awareness of who we really are. And I use the word stargate because I really do believe that we come from the stars, and that within us is the potential of mastery, of manifestation, and our heart's dreams. It's a matter of turning in. And I know after going 26 times to Egypt, there's no place better than to be inside the Great Pyramid and at the Paws of the Sphinx to receive a special blessing and a downpouring of this special energy. So it's actually a very important time to be at sacred places, especially Egypt.
Well, can you tell us what are the sacred places that you'll be visiting?
Well, we'll be visiting all of the temples along the Nile. Plus, we go to Dendera and Abydos, which are two amazing schools of higher learning that the Egyptians had. And the hieroglyphs are still encoded with messages that you can look and be downloaded with. We'll be at the Giza Plateau in Saqqara. We have the Great Pyramid for 2 hours on 11-11, and we'll also be at the Paws of the Sphinx. It is an exclusive, fabulous 14-day journey at a very reasonable price. because I had a spiritual experience in Egypt, I am dedicated to empowerment, soul empowerment, and to being people to sacred sites the best way I can.
Wonderful. And I know you have expertise. You, in fact, are an old friend who has helped me with tours to my special sacred sites in England. And you really have been doing this quite a while. And your expertise, as I say, you're a global researcher, and you're a wonderful practical alchemist and spiritual historian. This is the 26th visit that you'll be making to Egypt. Give us an idea of what you've witnessed, if there's anything that is special that's really stood out over the last 26 years.
I think because Egypt is a key to the enduring mysteries, and there's such a draw, people truly are being called home to Egypt. Never before many Americans stayed away, but this year so many American groups that I know have gone to Egypt and have felt the energy and come back and truly inspired to create a new heaven and a new earth. It's just the way Egypt is, and after all of these times and all of the research that I stay longer to do, there's always something new. It is also my knowingness and my research work that something amazing, amazing is coming forth from Egypt archaeologically either this fall or early next year.
Wonderful. I would love to go back. I suggest every spiritual warrior go to Egypt. The energies are so powerful there, and the veils are so thin between the dimensions. So it is a very special thing to witness. And you said you have 2 hours in the Great Pyramid.
I'm very blessed. I've worked with Dr. Hawass and many people in Egypt since 1982. And because of that, my joy is to make miracles in the moment. My joy is to add as much as I can to make this experience to change your life and to have the most empowering spiritual transformational journey anyone could have.
Well, your website, why don't you give that to the audience and they can go on that and get your information.
Yes. If anybody is drawn to Egypt or feel that they would like just to see if they're drawn to Egypt, please go to my website, which is www.joytravelonline.com. And the first program right there is Egypt. It has all of the information and what we'll be doing, our workshops, our seminars, our guest speakers, all of that is on the web.
And for those who, well, obviously most people would have to be on the web to be able to hear this program. But I will also give the 800 number for
please.
You, and that's 800-569-5010.
Yes.
And I want to thank you so much, Vonda, for being on our show.
Carrie, thank you so much, and I'm looking forward to the next portion of your radio show. Thank
okay,
you.
Okay, sweetheart. Bye-bye. And now, without further ado, let me introduce our main guest here. That's Bruce Lipton, Ph.D. He is an internationally recognized authority in bridging science and spirit. A cell biologist by training, he taught cell biology at the University of Wisconsin School of Medicine and later performed pioneering studies at Stanford University's School of Medicine. He's been a guest speaker on dozens of TV and radio shows, as well as a keynote speaker for national conferences. His breakthrough studies on the cell membrane have foretold that the new science of epigenetics would be essential to survival for our civilization, and he has been the leading voice of this new biology. Welcome, Dr. Lipton.
Thank you so much, Carol. I so appreciate this opportunity. And I want to thank Vonda for her support. And I hope she really gets lots of excited people to go, because I just went to Egypt for the first time last month. And it's a very auspicious time to go and touch the energy that she was talking about. And indeed, some profound changes are happening, and it's actually very exciting. And although some people may paint a very gloomy picture, as a biologist, I have a very much more enjoyable, exciting, and more beautiful picture unfolding.
Well, you have written this wonderful book called The Biology of Belief, And I was just so excited when I got to read that. And yes, you are an optimist, and thank God. And you are a spiritual scientist. Wow.
Weird because, Carol, when I started, I got into the sciences to avoid spirituality. When I was a kid, and I had all these spiritual people giving me advice, and in my little kid's eyes looking at them thinking, well, their life doesn't look that great. I thought, there were going to be other truths for me. So I actually avoided the spiritual path and went into science because I really believed that was where we were going to find the truths of our world. And I was so excited doing that. And of course, the biggest surprise of my entire life is at some point I got so deep into the science that I came out the other side of a spiritual, and it was like, blew my mind because it's like I didn't believe in it. And
well, obviously you had a pivotal moment.
It was a moment. I mean, it was like a difference of 1 minute of my whole life up to this 1 minute, not spiritual, and then about 30 seconds later, it's like spirituality in my scientific awareness had to exist as much as 2 + 2 = 4. It's like not arguable. I just looked at it and went, oh, my God.
You were studying the cell membrane. Tell us about the epiphany that you had and what went on at that transformational point in your life.
Well, what I was doing was continuing research that I had started at the University of Wisconsin and then extended to Stanford University at this point. And basically what the research revealed was that I was working with stem cells. And it's very interesting because a lot of people think stem cells are relatively recent or something. You know, they've just been hearing about them. I actually cloned my first stem cell cultures back in 1967. So that was 40 years ago. And I was working with these cloned stem cells. And what was important about these studies is that essentially I'd isolate one single cell and put it into a culture dish and then let it divide, and then it would be 2, and then they'd divide 4, 8, 16, 32, and pretty soon I'd have thousands of cells. What was very important though was that every cell was genetically identical because they came from the same parent cell. So I then split up this large petri dish of cells into 3 different petri dishes, and I changed the growth medium ever so slightly in each of the 3 different dishes. But they were genetically identical cells in each dish. And in the first dish, the cells formed bone. The second dish, the cells formed muscle. And the third dish, the cells formed fat cells. And here I am teaching and doing research at a medical school and teaching the concept of genetic control. And what that experiment was just like right in your face said, well, what controls the fate of the cell? Why did it become muscle or bone? And you start with the fact that they were all genetically identical cells and then recognize the only thing that was different was the environment. And so here I am teaching that genes control life, and my research is revealing just the complete opposite. It was the environment that the cells were in that controlled the cell, not the genes. And so at some point it actually caused me, I left the University of Wisconsin just because I realized at some point we were not teaching the correct science, and that propagating this belief about gene control was propagating a belief that people still have today, unfortunately, and that I'm talking about the people in the mass audience, not the research scientists, which are the small little tiny number percent. But the mass audience out there has still got a belief to some degree that genes are controlling their attributes and their biology, et cetera, in their lives. And it turns out this research that I did back at the end of the 70s, revealed completely the opposite. It just said that genes have potentials, but those potentials are realized by interacting with the environment. And the difference between this is like night and day, meaning what I was teaching in the class was genetic determinism. Genes control your life. And therefore, if anything, you might talk about yourself as a victim of your own heredity, that things like diseases like cancer, cardiovascular disease running in your family, and you feel like, oh, my God, these genes have destined me to this. And so that's genetic determinism. And yet the new research revealed, no, that the genetic expression wasn't controlling it. It was the situation in the environment that was influencing the genetic expression. And why that was so different is genetic control, you're a victim, but it, with this new understanding, it says you, if you change the environment, you change the biology, and all of a sudden you start to realize, well, you have freedom to go change the environment and do what you want. And basically it says the new biology versus the old. The old is victim, genetic determinism. New biology is change your perception of the environment, and you can change your genetic expression. And then you become master of your biology. And this is what the new biology is all about.
Mm-hmm. Wow. So it's the environment that controls and activates the gene.
This is profoundly important.
Mm-hmm.
This is important because, as I said, you can manipulate the environment. That means you have control.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore, we have been controlling our genes, but unfortunately, we were unaware that we were controlling our genes. And what the new biology revealed is that the skin of the cell is the equivalent of an information processor, basically. It on one side of the skin, there are receptors, and these are protein antennas that are reading the environmental information. Well, it's interesting because a human and a cell are physical representations of each other. So it's interesting because I talk about your own skin. Your skin is filled with receptors that read the environment, such as your eyes, ears, nose, taste, touch, pain, pressure, heat. All those receptors throughout your skin are devices that read the environment and then interpret that information and send it back in and control your biology with it. Well, this is what was happening with the cell. The skin of the cell has these receptors, and the relevance about it is whatever the information that the receptors see, like the cell's equivalent of eyes and ears, they make a response to the environment, which means adjusting their genetics to what's going on in the environment so that an organism and an environment become almost complementary to each other. So in a healthy environment, guess what? You have healthy cells. And if the environment is not so healthy, then the cells also start to get sick. And so it becomes important to see that our biology is adjustable all of the time based on how we perceive the environment, how we respond to the things that are going on around us. And that's what controls our genes. Mm-hmm. And ultimately, almost every illness on this planet, there's only about 5% of the people that actually have a genetic defect that provides for some bad attribute or something that's not working right in their lives. The 95% of us came here with a set of genes that we should have a perfectly happy, healthy, and very long life existence, at least 140 years. And so basically it says, what happened to these people with all these illnesses, with cancer and diabetes and heart conditions and all that? And we've been blaming it on our frail bodies when it turns out it's our own perception and response to the environment that initiates these issues. And so rather than, again, being the victims of a body that's vulnerable, we're really more or less victims of our own belief systems.
So, yeah, the mind-body connection.
This is where it is,
really,
right at the cell level.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And so it,
well,
what
are
it does,
perceptions?
Yeah.
I mean, how do they function? What's going on?
Okay. Yeah, let's just do a simple one. So we can start with a simple example, okay? You walk outside of your house, and it's really cold out. Well, you know that because the receptors in your skin read the environment that is cold. So what do? Send information into the nervous system. The nervous system interprets this as being cold and says to the machinery of the body, I have to raise the temperature to keep you warm, so the body temperature starts going up. So you're keeping yourself warmer in the cold weather. And then look at this. You walk out the door, and rather than being cold, it's hot. And the skin receptors pick up that it's hot, and the brain interprets it's hot, and it changes the biology to then cool you down so you perspire and change your blood flow. And basically what I'm talking about is you just adjusted your biology to the responses of what was going on in the environment. And that's a simple version, but it really applies to virtually everything in our lives, including how we respond to people in our community and how we respond to what's going on in the job or how we respond to what's going on in the news. It's the same mechanism as responding to hot or cold. The brain interprets what's going on and then adjusts the biology to sustain that life in that environment.
Mm-hmm. So basically, it's an awareness of the environment or receptors that send the stimuli or effectors to engage the cell system.
Right. It's just like light switches on the surface of the cell that respond to temperature or, let's say, in the body, cells respond to hormones like estrogen or testosterone or any of the nerve factors that are released from nerves or any of the chemistry of regulation. The cells have receptors that read that, so when those chemicals come into the field, the cell says, oh, I'm supposed to do this. It's sort of just like the chemical turns the light switch on, and whatever chemical it is turns on a very specific function. So the biology is always integrated into the environment. And of course, what that means right away is there's a global profound problem here, is that we were created in an environment that we're destroying. And the relevance about that is that by destroying our environment, essentially, we start to destroy ourselves because we've been adjusting ourselves to an environment that is actually disappearing right now, which is causing us a crisis, but which is also going to cause us a consequence of recovery. Boy, am I going on with this. basically saying that, yes, we're in a process of major change in this world right now, and it's a biologically driven aspect as well as a socially driven aspect, because they become integrated when you understand the nature of the biology of belief, that our beliefs about each other, about our cultures, about our world, about our environment, all these beliefs interface our biology and control our biology.
Mm-hmm. Well, and we're so competitively driven in this society, and what you say is what we need really to survive and thrive is cooperation and, you know, a sense of community. And it's funny because the way you describe the cancer cells, they're as though they're the renegades who have, you know, gone off disharmoniously, and they're living off by, they're homeless, actually, and they're living off of others.
Yeah.
Which is kind of an interesting...
It's
a wonderful metaphor.
Yeah, but people should know that it's actually even more closely to something like what we almost say a homologue, meaning that story is essentially a real story when you understand that the human body is not a single one thing as we might perceive it when we look in the mirror. The human body is actually a community of upwards to 50 trillion living cells. It's actually, the cells are the living organisms. We are collective communities of upwards to 50 trillion cells. And why that becomes relevant is if you shrink yourself down to the size of a cell, you recognize that a cell has all the same functions that a human has. Mm-hmm. It has all the digestive, respiratory systems, the nervous, reproductive, expiratory system. Every cell even has an immune system. So basically, in truth, every cell is the equivalent of a miniature person living in a large community of 50 trillion citizens. And our mind, which perceive and interpret the world, is, in a sense, the government of 50 trillion cells. And so their fate and their harmony and their happiness is dependent on the organizing activity of the central government, the mind. And unfortunately, many people's minds give a lot of negative feedback about life and themselves and all that, and they don't realize that this negative broadcast in their mind is being sent to 50 trillion cells who are reading this because their lives are totally connected to the central voice, this mind. And therefore, if we irritate our own population like a government could cause a lot of strife in its own country, that leads to a revolution where individuals pull out of the community and don't support that community anymore. Cancer turns out to be a very similar story in the community of the human body, where anger or not resolving issues leads to an irritation of specific individual cells, which then ultimately provokes what, you know, mentioned as homeless cells. They pulled out of the community. They're still in there living, but they're not supporting the system. And at some point, they go off on their own, and if you don't resolve the issues in your own community by meaning adjusting your mind as the government and sending better information to your cells, that this cancer could be very aggressive and be lethal at some point. And yet, the other positive side of this thing is, if you understand the irritation that provoked something like that cancer and resolve those issues, then the cancer itself goes into remission.
Mm-hmm. Well, so it sounds like it's as simple as mind over matter, but I know it's not that simple.
I wish it is as simple as that, but then there's a conflicting little piece of the data that people aren't informed of, and then all of a sudden the whole beautiful concept of positive thinking and mind over matter, well, intellectually sounds really good, doesn't work for a lot of people because they fail to understand there's another piece to this puzzle. And that is, yes, positive thinking is the mind sending these wonderful messages to the body. But we have to recognize that the mind actually has two fundamental elements that are distinctly different from each other. And one is called the conscious mind, and the other is called the subconscious mind. Now, they're profoundly different in their functions. The conscious mind is the one connected to your spiritual identity, your source. It's the one that has your desires, your wishes, your aspirations. It's the creative mind. This is the one that says, I want to be healthy, I want to have wonderful relationships, I want to have a great job. That comes from the conscious mind. Those are your personal issues and desires. In contrast, a supporting element of the conscious mind is the equivalent of the autopilot called the subconscious mind. And the subconscious mind learns from experiences of repetition and then records programs of behavior that are repeated. And after they're recorded, all you have to do is push the button and the behavior will automatically replay itself continuously playing the same program over and over again. Well, the problem with that is that the subconscious mind, now here's where the conflict comes from. Both minds are involved with running the body, number one. But here's the differential. The subconscious mind is 1,000,000 times more powerful than the creative conscious mind as a processor. It's 1,000,000 times more powerful. And here's the other scary fact. It operates 95% of the day for most people, if not more. Meaning, on an average person's day, they run 5% or less from their conscious mind and 95% from their subconscious mind. You say, well, what's the difference? And again, the conscious mind is what your creative mind is. It's your desires. It's what you want in life. And the other mind is just plays programs. Now, here's where the catch is. The primary programs in the subconscious mind were acquired when we were still in utero, so in our fetal stages of development, through the first 5 to 6 years of our lives, programs were installed into our subconscious mind by observing our parents, our family, our community, our teachers, and downloading whatever they said as fact into the subconscious mind. Now, to give people an understanding of what was going on here, we have a conscious mind, which is a thinking, creative one. We have a subconscious mind, which is a program one. And when a child's born, it can't have consciousness for a reason. If I buy you a new iPod and you open up the box and take it out of the box and you push play, nothing happens. There's nothing to play. There's no information in it. So what you have to do is first you have to program the information in, and then you can select the play and play the music and do whatever you want with it. So playing it is like the conscious mind, but the programs are the subconscious mind. Well, here's the point. The brain doesn't offer us consciousness as a function until about 5 years of age when it becomes a predominant brain state, 5 to 6. The reason is, if a child's one just born, and you say, well, think of something, use that creative mind, the child's like, obviously, there's nothing to think about. There's no data yet. So the first 5 years, neurodevelopment provides for the programming of the subconscious mind, which then, when consciousness starts, uses that as a database to create life from. So here's the catch. The subconscious mind, the primary programs, by nature, came from other people. The conscious mind, by its design, is you. And your desires are in the conscious mind. The programs that you got from other people contain their beliefs and their desires, and usually they quite differ from what you want. And then when you go back, they say, well, wait, in regard to operation, you recognize that the conscious mind, the one that has your desires in it, only operates 5% of the time. 95% of the time, we're operating from the subconscious mind, which was programmed with the beliefs of other people, which almost inevitably conflict with what you want. Then you do the math and you say, what are the chances of your life working out the way you want with your conscious mind? You realize, well, 5% input isn't that great. And then you say, yeah, but if I was running the subconscious mind and it was limiting me or sabotaging me, I'd be totally aware of that, of course. And I'm saying, no, that's why they call it the unconscious or subconscious mind, is because it operates when your conscious mind is busy and you're not paying attention. That's when it does its programs, and then you're not aware of it. So, quick example: you get in the car on the first day with a driver's permit. You don't have any idea how to drive a car. You actually have to learn. So there's the learning part where you do repetition, and after the repetition part, the program of how to drive is in the subconscious mind. You don't have to think about it. In fact, if you get involved with a wonderful conversation with a passenger, and you're driving and driving, and then some moment you look out the window and you realize, well, I haven't paid attention to the road for the last 10 minutes. And I said, don't worry, the subconscious mind, which is a million times more powerful than your conscious mind, was handling the car, but it was handling it away according to the way you programmed that mind. So your driving was exactly the way you programmed it, and without you paying attention. And one last thing, which I say in audiences, and most people are familiar with it, I say, look, you know somebody, and you know their parent, and you recognize that your friend shares the same behavior as their parent. So one day you feel like volunteering, you know, and you go, you know, Bill, you're just like your dad. And then you realize that Bill is in shock that you actually compared him to his dad. And a lot of people are familiar with this, but the joke part of it is, well, everyone sees that Bill is like his dad except for Bill. And that becomes very profound, because it's a reflection of the fact that our automatic programs play, and we're generally unaware of them because they're automatic and unconscious. And therefore, we look at our life and say, where am I today and where do I want to go? And if I'm there or if I'm not there, and if I'm not there, and I'm saying, well, why am I not where I want? Why don't I have the relationship or the health that I want? Because we've had this belief that our conscious mind has been running the show, and then that was our desire to have health or relationships, and we didn't get them. Therefore, we have a tendency to say, oh, man, I'm such a victim. The universe isn't really giving me stuff. And it really turns out is that we sabotage ourselves with programs we didn't see, because they were programmed by other people, and almost all of those are limiting and self-sabotaging programs. And so basically, for the empowerment and the transformation that you've been talking about, we have to recognize that we have a drive in our conscious mind to experience that transformation, to participate in it, to see it and welcome it. And yet we have to recognize that even though that's our conscious desire, our programs of limitation in our subconscious mind generally get in the way of us experiencing those things. And so that the empowerment that we need to understand is the new biology. And that new biology says that you are actually creating the life that you have, but unfortunately 95% came from the other programs. And you're really recreating a life that other people programmed for you. And yet you can change those programs, and in so doing, completely change your biology and, in regard to the genetics, actually change the genetic expression by your experiences in your life. And this is the new genetics.
Mm-hmm. You know, you're speaking to now my expertise. I'm a hypnotherapist and a counselor of over 25 years. And, you know, I teach that the subconscious mind has the programs which create our reality.
Yes.
And when people hear that, it's really quite an awakening to understand that. And you're so wonderful in that you really do give the answers that we need to really get to the negative belief system that's been operating our lives.
Yeah,
and you know, have people change that. Yeah, yeah. Would you also?
And the scary part, though, Carol, is that most people, I said, you see, the programs that are in our subconscious mind, we got before we were even really conscious. So mm-hmm. most of the fundamental beliefs that we operate from are almost invisible to us because we never even saw that we were programmed with them. And yet
yeah.
they play when we're not paying attention.
Yeah. Well, and so much is changing. Do you see the medical community coming along, changing, or what's happening? Are they picking up on this?
Slowly, but they are, and that's important because I started lecturing on this information about 1985, and I have to tell you, I think 15 years went by before medical doctors would show up to my lecture, and since about 2000. They're continuously increasing in numbers in the audience because I think they really hit the wall and realized that the program and training that they got in the medical school was not fully complete. And the limitations of that programming are the stuff that are outside of mainstream science, which collectively may be referred to as a spiritual new age, new thought, community stuff. Well, that's basically, that thought is predicated on energy fields being important in shaping matter, and conventional medicine doesn't recognize energy fields, so that's been the disconnect, and yet, obviously it works because so many people have been profoundly influenced by changing their beliefs and attitudes and taking control of their lives. And it's time to understand that these aren't miracles, these are just technologies that we're unaware of. And science is now opening up to these technologies, and I would love to say, yes, they're gonna grow really fast into this stuff, but there's an impediment in the way, and it's the pharmaceutical industry.
Thank you.
Which has no desire in their world to see this happen, because basically what it says is you can heal yourself much more effectively with your mind than with any of the chemistry that they sell.
I mean, Big Pharma is really kind of mucking up the waters for people. Obviously, we can heal ourselves. I mean, you know, when we start realizing that we have our own best pharmaceutical shop right inside our bodies, what an awakening that is.
As well as these stem cells. People think, you know, like, what are these? They're special cells. You probably have to go to the pharmacy and buy them or something like that. And the reality is, no, every human that's alive and staying alive has stem cells, and they're functioning every day in your life, because every day you're losing billions of your cells just to usage and old age. And these cells are replaced every day by stem cells. So basically, built into every human body are a population of stem cells, which are essentially the equivalent of embryonic cells whose potentials can be anything in the human body, anything that needs to be replaced. The jack-of-all-trades cells, they will fix any tissue or organ in our body. And then all of a sudden we realize, well, why are we trying so hard to get these stem cells to work in the pharmaceutical industry? You know, why are they trying to control them so much? And then you'd have to say, well, you'd almost think that their performance suggests that God gave us stem cells, but no way to use them until the pharmaceutical company would figure it out for us. And the reality is, that's so crazy, you know. The idea is, we all have stem cells. Well, they'll do whatever it is that our mind suggests they do, and that's where the issues come from, is because most of us have been programmed with a belief that we do not heal ourselves, that the doctor heals us. And as a result, since the mind controls biology, if the mind says that you do not heal yourself, that a doctor does it, then guess what? Even though you have the ability to heal yourself, you will not start that healing process and that belief until you go to the doctor. And the joke, of course, I love it, is that many people get well on the way to the doctor. And the reason is simply the program. It was just a program, just like a computer program in the mind that says, healing, first go to the doctor, then do healing. It didn't say the doctor had to do anything. All it said you just had to do is go to the doctor. And the mind, once you engage this process, will then activate the self-healing process. And that's why so many people, as they get to the doctor, feel so much better, because they allowed the system to engage without knowing that they were programmed to inhibit the system until getting the approval of that doctor.
Mm-hmm. Well, people, you've been listening to Carrie L's Heartlink Show, and our guest, Dr. Bruce Lipton, he has just given us so much information, and I want you to also announce your website, Bruce. Why don't you go ahead and do
Yeah,
that?
I appreciate that, because, of course, I talk fast, and the ideas went here and there, but on the website there are lots of free articles and references to download and lots of things to read about this new biology. The website, BruceLipton.com.
Oh, that's
Lipton
easy.
Like tea.
Uh-huh. All right, www.BruceLipton.com.
Easy.
And are there any events coming up that you'd like to announce to our audience? Anything
oh, I'm going to the big Hay House You Can Do It program in Las Vegas this weekend. Should be about 9,000 or so people coming out, new thinking people, the people that are the people like listening to your show right now, who I so appreciate, because the subject of my new book is the fact that we are in the process of experiencing an unbelievable evolutionary leap in humanity right now. And it's interesting because when you look around the world, it looks very scary with all the crises and threats and extinction stuff looming in front of us like that. And it might be hard to adjust your sights, but the relevance of this is it's actually related to like a pupa, a larva that's growing every day, and inside the larva, just like inside your body, are these cells, millions and millions of cells, making the community called a larva. And every day the cells are out there working, and the larva is growing, and everything is good. You know, the economy is moving in that little world of cells, and everything's in good growth. And then all of a sudden one day the growth seems to slow down. And then it seems to actually even stop, and the population of cells are like, oh, my God, it's the end. You know, the cells actually biologically commit suicide, a process which is recognized as called apoptosis, in this, like, destruction of the civilization. It's falling apart. So if you were a cell in that larva right now, you'd be, like, looking at this planet going, it looks a little scary around here right now. And so the point is, you can be scared, but then here's the beautiful part about that. From among the cells in that larva, there are a group of individual cells that start to get together that think different. They're genetically identical, but they think different than the conventional cells of the larva. And these cells, called imaginal cells, which I just love the name, imaginal cells, come together and create a structure that exceeds everything the larva was. It builds a butterfly. And a whole new organism evolves from the dissolution of the first, with the cells from the first coming to become part of the cells of the second. Well, what's going on in the world today is that humanity is evolving. It's going through this equivalent of a metamorphosis. The destruction or crises that are surrounding us are necessary, because to build the foundation of this new butterfly version of humanity requires a different foundation. And so it's an inevitable evolution, and 2012 apparently ties into this as a point of a transformational event where we actually then recognize, I guess, the butterfly has left the larva behind by then. But what's really interesting is that the futurists that talk about 2012 and the transformation also refer to the chaos that precedes the transformation. That is the chaos that we're beginning to see now, where the world's shaking and looking strange. And again, you have to have this chaos in order to create better structures to support humanity for its future survival, because the current structures are expressing themselves in the crises that we're experiencing right here. So you can look at the outside and you have two choices. You know, you can look at, oh my God, it's the end of the world, I'm scared to death, and of course that will not help your health in any sense of the way. Or you could start to recognize, and I presume you see that the audience and your listenership is out there, are imaginal cells. They are out there thinking different now. They need to learn this stuff. And it's going to be great, because this new biology, which reveals the mechanisms of how your thoughts and your subconscious collectively are shaping your biology and health, when that becomes understood by the average lay audience person, then they have the awareness or the knowledge to to impact their lives, because it's not just knowledge, it's knowledge of self. And knowledge of self translates as self-empowerment when knowledge is power. So we're becoming self-empowered with a new knowledge of who we are. And that's why if you see this stuff coming on and it looks scary, and you also start to recognize, wait, I can detach from this and find that all these other people are out here building a new foundation and a more healthy, holistic kind of life foundation, not based on competition as we started with, but based on the nature that evolution actually was created under. And that was, evolution is the expression of cooperation. All you have to do is look at the environment and see how every organism is cooperating with every other organism to create that environment. And here we as the human population have been misperceiving this and figuring that evolution was totally based on this competition. And the competition is predominantly one of the instigating issues in the collapse of our system. This inevitable tearing each other apart competition is destroying the fabric of humanity in the process, as well as destroying the garden that nature provided as well. So I hope everybody realizes, okay, big things happening, and look on the bright side, because the new evolution is going to be fabulous. It's going to be fabulous because people are going to recognize what's important in this world, and it's not another SUV.
Well, and you conclude your work with that evolution is based upon fractal geometry. And I'm not going to let you get off the program until you can explain that.
Well, that's a big question. Yeah, but let's see if I really, it's so fabulous a question. So in the next 12 hours, let me elaborate. basically, geometry is the math of how you put structure into space. So you design structure using geometry. The math that most of us learned in school is called Euclidean geometry. It's the one we did with graph paper, and we put cubes and spheres and cones and objects in there and created those objects, which are the same kind of geometry that we build our buildings with and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
But here's the issue. Using Euclidean geometry, you can't really create a picture of mountains and clouds and trees very easily, because they're unnatural. When we were 5 years old, we made a Euclidean geometry tree. We made a cylinder with a ball on the top, and that was our primitive version of a tree, but obviously it doesn't look like a tree. There's a new geometry that's relatively new, although the idea of it was from before the 1900s, 1983 or so. The new geometry was introduced, called fractal geometry. It's a very simple mathematics, and it has what are called iterated equations. Now, that's a bigger word than actually the simple nature of iterated means repeated equation. So you take an equation and you just repeat it inevitably over and over and over and keep doing it. And how you do it is this. You solve the equation, and the answer you get from the equation, you feed it back into the equation and solve it again. And then the answer you get the next time, you put it back into the equation and solve it again. So basically a simple version. Take a line and cut it in half. That's the equation. So you, the first line you cut in half, now you have two halves. So you take one of those halves, put it back in the equation. It says take a line, cut it in half. So you cut that in half. Now you have a quarter of a line. You take that quarter, put it back in the equation, cut it in half. Now you have an eighth of a line. And the point is, well, how many times can you do that? And the answer is, infinitely, as long as you keep blowing up the picture, you can keep cutting the lines in half all the time. Well, all of that stuff means you're using the same equation and repeating it infinitely, and there's a character in it that is most fabulous. And the character is this. As a consequence of repeating the equation, the images are repeated in a self-similar fashion at different levels of the organization, meaning the same images reappear in your graphing of these pictures at higher or lower levels of the organization. People refer to it like the Russian nesting dolls, where you have these wooden dolls and you open up the first wooden doll and there's another one inside. It's almost the same as the first, but not exactly. And then you open that up and there's a smaller one inside, which is almost like that one, but not exactly, self-similar. And then you say, so what does all this mean, all these words, Lipton? What are you saying? And here's what I'm saying. The fractal geometry with repeated equations leads to the repetition of images and different levels of organization, which in summary represents as above, so below. It is the geometry of that well-known and thousands of year old awareness that the structure above and the structure below are very similar to each other and they repeat. And why this is important is that humanity is an animal in a sense that it's a living organism, and all of us are cells in the body of humanity. As much as if I could shrink you down to the size of a cell in your own body, you would see your body, called the human, is made out of all these small citizens called 50 trillion cells, and humanity is a living body where we're the cells in it. And why that's relevant, then, it says, then the evolution of humanity would be self-similar to the evolution of animals. And so in a very rapid unfoldment, I would say, animals evolved in a pattern that all of us are familiar with, let's say at the vertebrate level. First there were fish, then there were amphibians, then there were reptiles, and then there were birds, and then there were mammals. So if evolution is fractal, then humanity would go through a self-similar character of fish, amphibians, reptiles, birds, and mammals in its evolution. So, yes, we went through the fish part thousands of years ago in cultures that were called maricultures, where people couldn't leave the water. Like fish, they couldn't travel inland because if they didn't have the water, they would die. So like fish, they could only stay where the water was. And they were the earliest peoples, and they cultivated the edges of the continents by boats going from one side to the other. But you couldn't go onto the land yet because the technology wasn't developed until the period we went from mariculture to agriculture. Agriculture was like amphibians, meaning amphibians were the organisms that could take the water with them onto the land. So we went from mariculture to a period of agriculture. The next level of evolution improved the mechanics of a body for land life versus the amphibian, which was really designed to be in the water. So the evolution of the land body gave rise to the reptiles, and they're like machines. They're almost like digital machines. Their eyes click and their tongues dart, and they almost click like animals. And so the relevance is you go fish, amphibians, reptiles, where we went mariculture, agriculture, industrial age. And the reptile is the mechanical period. And it's interesting because the reptiles, a big inflated branch of reptiles, were the dinosaurs. So we look at the small lizards and reptiles as mom-and-pop shops, and the dinosaurs are corporations. And the fact is that during the industrial age, with the dinosaurs and all the corporations, the industrial age is fueled by nothing other than the blood of the dinosaurs. So it's like, oh, my God, the character of our civilization, we're using oil. And that was from that dinosaur period. So that it's a very interesting parallel. But the dinosaurs gave rise to the birds. The industrial age gave rise to the age of aviation with Wilbur and Orville Wright. Mm-hmm. They got off the ground, and civilization changed from that point because with air transportation and the perspective that we got from the air gave us a new view of our world. Well, the evolution of the aviation phase of human civilization went from the Wright brothers to landing on the moon in 1969. Mm-hmm. And this is an interesting point because now we've gone into from the reptiles to the birds, and guess what? When the birds, the aviation civilization, landed on the moon and they took a picture of the Earth, that picture came back in 1969 and started Earth Day and all the belief about, oh my God, all we have is that little blue-green gem in the sky. And we must take care of it. We have to take care of the air, take care of the water, take care of the kids, taking care. And it's like, guess what? Taking care is the character called nurturing, and nurturing is the character of the mammal. And so we went from mariculture to agriculture to the industrial age to the flight age, the aviation age, and seeded in 1969 was a new civilization belief that survival is based on taking care of the planet. And so we go back over evolutionary history and realize the dinosaurs that gave rise to the birds and to the mammals, the dinosaurs were there when the mammals were there and the birds were there. So all three were there, but the dinosaurs ruled over everything. And then guess what? the day the dinosaurs crashed because the environment was unstable and they weren't able to maintain themselves. Then when the dinosaurs crashed, the meek took over, the mammals took over. And so if you're looking at where are we in this evolutionary scale, well, the mammals as a civilization state were seeded in 1969 with a picture of the Earth from the moon. They've been growing very slowly, but their numbers are increasing now at significant rates. Your audience out there, part of this mammal group and nurturers that want to take care of themselves and the planet. And you have the dinosaurs, the big petroleum corporations, the government the way it is, the giant corporations, the pharmaceutical industry, all these things are the dinosaurs. And likely anticipation is the dinosaurs will crash like they did before, environmental instability, maybe by the end of this year even, beginning the chaos that in 2012 the leadership of civilization is handed over to the people that constitute the mammals, the nurturers of the planet.
And so
what we're looking at outside is the collapse of the dinosaur structure, the corporate world and the money and all that stuff, and the materialization, and moving into a mammal world. And it's interesting because the parallel with this is dinosaurs are conscious but not self-conscious, and mammals are self-conscious. The difference, an organism that's conscious lives at the moment and doesn't think about the future because in its mind it's only now. That's all they have. Self-conscious organisms recognize that what they do today will influence what they do tomorrow, so they base what they do today on the influence of what happens tomorrow. And you realize that our current government is so reptilian. I mean, they could get us into an Iraq war and not even think 6 weeks away. I mean, this is how reptilian it was. We need the war now. And so that means right now, living right now, and somebody, if a mammal was doing it, say, well, if you have a war, what would be the consequence of having this war? But we didn't have mammals. We had reptiles, and they said, have a war. and then when it came time that 6 weeks later and the war was, you know, winding down, they didn't even have a plan because they didn't anticipate the future. So you can
well,
see.
We are anticipating the end of our show, Bruce.
Oh, no. I need to be other 11 hours now. Okay. All right, Cheryl.
And on that note, again, it's a wonderful note that we are shifting and that 2012
yes.
is all about the nurturer coming into power. Thank goodness.
Yes, it's going to be beautiful.
Wonderful. And you have been listening to Dr. Bruce Lipton on Carrie L's Heartlink Show. And thank you, Bruce, so much for your being on my program.
Well, I thank you. I hope I didn't make so many words that people say, what did he say? I hope something came out.
They'll have to listen to it over and over again on my archives.
Oh, there are always little bits of pieces that will come out. That's great.
Yeah, well, you're great, and thank you, and I would love to have you on again. And people, if you listen next time, we'll have Dr. Hank Weffelman on. And thank you for listening and connecting to this wonderful energy as we've had our guest, Dr. Bruce Lipton. And I look forward to next time on Carrie L's Heartlink. That's www.heartlinkinstitute.com. Check that out. And check out brucelipton.com. Bye-bye.